this thing on? Is it working? I'm not too sure. It's the news, I think, according to me. Good morning. It is, I think it's Wednesday. I believe it's Wednesday, May 21st, 10 o'clock a.m. I was going to do a live show today. It's not going to be a live show today, by the way. It's not live. This isn't live. I'm recording it live. I'm live while I'm recording it, but it's not live right now. I was really thinking about doing it. Not going to work out. Tomorrow's not going to work out. Hopefully, Friday morning will work out. There's always a possibility of a doctor appointment that I may have to take somebody to. I won't mention any names, but happen to be married to her. She might have to go to the doctor. Tomorrow's going to be a really busy day. I woke up this morning for some reason. When I first woke up, I thought it was Thursday. What was going on with that? Somehow missed Wednesday altogether and ended up with Wednesday. It is Wednesday, May 21st, 10 o'clock a.m., 10:03 now, I guess. 2025, and we have quite a few listeners here. It seems like it keeps popping up more and more. The peak, it peaks out about every 7 or 8 days. I get this peak for some reason. It goes up a whole bunch and it goes down. It's like a heartbeat thing going on. But I've noticed that the peaks get higher, typically, as the consistency of the peaks getting higher. I guess that's a good sign. Or does that happen right before you die? I don't know how that works. Regardless, I'm in the worldwide headquarters this morning. Haven't been here for a while. Probably, has that been a week? Over a week since I've been in the worldwide headquarters doing a show. I think last time I did a show from here, it was live. I do have a new router here. The old router failed. Went in and got a new one. Now I'm getting new routers at both the home. I have a backup router that's a backup service. So I use Verizon and T-Mobile both, and T-Mobile typically is kind of the main router that I use. It's a wireless system. It's a works off of the phone system, and so if one system is down, I can use the other. But the apparently there's this new and improved router. We just went into Verizon yesterday to work on some phone issues, and apparently. They happen to remind me. They say, "Hey, these routers that you've got, I have two. I have one for the house and one for the shop here at the office." And apparently, the routers that I have through Verizon, apparently they have a new and improved version, supposedly a little faster, but it's unlimited. It's an unlimited data plan. My other one was limited data plan, so I kind of used that as my backup. Because if you went over a certain amount, it throttled you back to like really slow speeds, and it got more expensive if you wanted to go faster for longer with that thing. So it was, this one happened to be kind of the way to go. It was just as a backup router, and it was wasn't very expensive. But the new one now is unlimited. It's an unlimited plan and a better router. It's the same brand router, I guess, but it's just an improved router experience with faster speeds. So we'll just see how that works out. There, you know, as things go, you know, technology just gets faster. Even the old stuff that works well gets outdated, and it doesn't matter whether it's still working or not. Just at some point, you gotta move on because there's more and more data out there. And when you stop and think about it, just in my little town here, was there 40,000 people here or something in the city limits here? It amazes me, you know, just about at least half those people have a cell phone, probably at least half. So think about, 20,000 cell phones, and I can send a text to text message to someone. I can send a picture to them, and it gets to their, gets there less than a minute. They've got it in their hand in less than a minute. Now think about that, and think about where we've been in the last 30 years. Just 30 years. where we're going to be in the next 30 years, but this idea that we can send stuff like that so ridiculously fast, and there's so many people doing it. All of this data every day, when you look at the amount of videos that are uploaded to YouTube every day, just one social media site, which of course is one of the largest, it just blows your mind to think of how much data is being transmitted. Much of it is wireless. Where is it all? You know, it's in our atmosphere. These frequencies are flying around with all this data all over the place. It's just absolutely amazing to me. And yet, at the same time, it's a little bit frightening. It's a little bit crazy. Maybe it's having an effect on our brains. Maybe it's having an effect on anything. I don't know. But that's one side of it. Then there's the other side of it. Is just, you know, how are they able to manage all this? This is ridiculously fast, you know, speeds for how they're managing all this stuff. So it's just, you know, it's amazing that we don't have more crossover data errors and all kinds of other blended, you know, even phone calls and everything else are just amazing. You know, it used to be with the old analog phones, the old analog cell phones. You could be driving down the road and all of a sudden you hear somebody else's conversation. There was this weird, it was called a reflection frequency thing. I can't remember what the name of the issue was, but you'd be going down the road and all of a sudden you'd either be in on somebody else's conversation or you could just hear it. And it was a ridiculous thing. Now that does not happen, by the way, with my cup. I have a cup here with my chai. I brought it from home, actually. It's a, of course, it's my vanilla creamer, big train with a little bit of Pacific chai mixed in there. And it's got a Almond Joy creamer, brand new Almond Joy creamer that I just broke open this morning. A fine vintage creamer that I opened up this morning. In my backup cup, which is not quite as good as it was yesterday. The tea itself is better. The tea I made this morning, home brewed my tea this morning. That's that fresh. It is probably, you know, it's got a little bit of melted ice on the top there. That's probably one of the best tasting teas I've made in a while with regard to the sweetness and the strength of the tea. However, I did slice up an entire peach and put it into the gallon that I finalized the tea in, because you have to steep it and then put the sugar in at a certain temperature, and it's above a certain temperature, and then you have to mix that up, and then you put that in, pour it over ice in the big pitcher, and then as that melts, then you put some more water in there, and bring it up to the right level and get the right consistency. And then you put I put the peaches in on top of the ice. And of course, the peach flavor had not really blended into the tea very well yet when I poured this cup this morning. But it's, so I don't really have a very slight hint of peach there. Only reason I can tell it's there is because I know it's there, probably. I don't know if anybody else would actually take. Let me see. Let me stir this up a little bit better and see if it's actually. I'll give you a better report. Yeah, I don't think a normal person would drink that and think there's any peaches in it. But it's definitely there's definitely just a little bit of the peach flavor there. Anyway, that all being said, there you go. Pretty good. So it's a pretty good morning here with the refreshment. The refreshment center over here is pretty decent. Now, onward and upward, we have a few things in the news. Now, I haven't checked the news this morning. I want to look at my actual feeds that I usually look at. I want to redo that one because I don't know what that is. Who's this? Education Secretary Linda McMahon testifies for us. So they're essentially getting rid of a bunch of programs. Now, or I should say agencies. I think the Department of Education, I guess, I understand it, it's officially gone. It's a done deal. Now, course, the left, you know, the left's heads are, you know, popping off. What they're finding, what Doge was finding out, was there was a whole lot of back channel stuff. A lot of organizations were being funded through the process of some of these agencies. They would have these little other NGOs, non-government agencies, that they would, organizations that they would funnel money off to. And of course, when the budgets were to get huge, and we need all this money to fund this program. When you have redundancy, for instance, they're getting rid of the Department of Education. So the left, all you heard on social media was that the student loans are going to be gone. They're going to get rid of all this stuff. All this stuff's going to go away. Oh, the meal program is going to go away. The meal program, first of all, is under the Department of Agriculture. It's not even under the Education Department of Education. So they make these things up. They say all this stuff, and they think that it's just going to be nothing. No federal programs for the students. That's not the case. Anything that's essential is being pushed off to other agencies, because when you can put everything under one roof, you know, when you stop to think about it. So you've got the head of the organization, you've got all the other management people at the top that you need to have in order to make everything at the grunt level work. And you have to duplicate that at every agency that you form. So all of that administration goes away. All the high-level, high-paying jobs that sap that organization of its budgetary efficiency is gone. So you're taking away all those funds that can now be funneled into more. That just means feeding more kids, because now you got the same budget, but now you're more effective. You can actually feed more kids. You can do more with that money because you're not spending it on somebody's salary, benefits, and all the other stuff they got. So those people are limited. They're just see you, bye. And that can happen, you know, and they're like, oh, we can't just eliminate these poor people's jobs. And yet you want to destroy companies. The left is losing so much credibility in the process. This whole process. Just think about the last 4 months. Basically, January, February, March, April, and May. So we are now in May, the middle of May. It's May 21st. The current administration has been in effect for 4 months and 1 day. Stop and think about that. And we have 4 years. Look at everything that's happened in the last 4 months, let alone what's going to happen in the next 4 years. And it's, we are truly setting, in my opinion, everything I'm seeing with regard to, but now Congress has to act. Congress has to get in on this, and they have to do it soon. The sooner the better. I'm not sure where we are with the big, beautiful bill. I'm not sure what's going on with that. There's some stuff in there I don't like, but most of it's pretty common sense, and it's most of it's, you know, okay, we'll just go necessary with whatever. It is a step in the right direction. I'll just put it that way. It is because it's going to codify a lot of things that Trump has done. Some of the things that are in there are no taxes on overtime, no taxes on tips, no taxes on Social Security. And the left is throwing a tizzy fit about all that stuff. We're not going to be able to come up with any. We're not going to have enough tax money to pay the bills. That's the whole problem right there. What you're saying right there is why we need Doge. Because we're spending too much. It's not a problem of how much they're taking. Believe me, they're taking a whole lot of money. And people are starting to wake up to some of this. I've noticed there's a lot of videos now on YouTube and Facebook, at least, where people are starting to do the math. There's this one bridge is it New York? Is it the Brooklyn Bridge? Whatever it is. They do these calculations. It's like 28,000 people a day use the bridge. It's $8 a person. It's $2 million a day, whatever it is. I think it was $2 million a day that the revenue is over $2 million a day, that the revenue from this bridge, from the tolls in this bridge, just the toll bridge revenue gross income per day alone was $2 million per day. You know, after 365 days in a year, that's almost $1 billion a year. Now, I realize that at some point that bridge is going to have to be, you know, I don't know what it cost. It didn't cost that much to put the bridge up initially. I'm sure that replacing it would cost that much. But how many years do you have to operate that thing, set money aside in order? Now, what the problem is, when they go to redo the bridge, they're not going to, there's not going to be any money there. It's not like they're putting money away and saving it for the next bridge. That money is being shuffled off and channeled off into all kinds of other things. I guarantee you. And the city, you know, just all the taxes that we pay, I don't think people realize that the burden that we are carrying with the amount of taxes. And I'm not talking about your income tax, even your federal income tax. There are taxes that you pay just buying a gallon of gas. Oh, you see the price and you think that's the price at the pump. Well, no, that's the price plus. They even put sales tax in there. It used to be you'd buy the gas and you still have to pay the sales tax on top of it because most people didn't, you know, just pay at the pump. They had all this other stuff going on. So you'd have to kind of figure out your sales tax. So when you tried to round it off to the nearest dollar or whatever you're trying to do with, of course, couldn't do that back when gas was like less than 50 cents a gallon because you couldn't get another gallon in there to get it to the next, like if you just had to round it off the next nearest 10 cents basically because it was just, you know, a penny a gallon made a huge difference back then. My dad taught me this very early on. I remember this when gas was 15 cents a gallon. And folks, I remember that. I was a little toddler. And I was, to this day, and we were living in Illinois. I know it was less than seven because we moved out of there when I was seven. But I think when I was, this is back in probably 19, I was, let's see if we can find out what the price of gas was in 1963. Let's see what it says here. Price of gas in, oops, not GAX, gas in 1963. This says 31 cents. Folks, I remember it being that's probably the average price. That is the average price of gas. Asking me all kinds of questions now. How cheap was gas in 1950? Let's see if it says anything there. By 1950, gas prices had jumped to 27 cents. Folks, I know that I saw gas prices in places in the country that were, because my parents used to have a trailer. They used to pull it around. They took me, I was just a little kid, and they had a little trailer, had a station wagon, and had a little trailer, and we pulled that thing around, went camping all over the country. This says 31 cents. In 1963, it was 30 cents a gallon. It was actually a penny higher. But I know I saw on gas pumps, maybe there was to get those Sinclair stamps and all that stuff that you used to get back in the day. You collect stamps. And if you buy, just get one stamp per gallon or whatever you got, and you collect those stamps and you could cash the stamps in on a set of glasses or whatever it was. And it's, I know that in our little town, we had gas well below 30 cents. I know that. And one of the things that my dad taught me was very early, and I remember this, I remember him saying it. Because there was there was two gas stations in town. And they had price wars, and it would be a penny. A penny was a price war. It was considered a price war because and I just thought, well, it's just a penny. But back then, a penny would get you a lot. A penny would buy you a candy bar. And candy bars are like a nickel for, you can go into a candy store with 10 cents and buy quite a bit of stuff. And let's say it was 30 cents a gallon, and you're going to buy 10 gallons, or 50, back then I think our tanks were usually 20 gallons. Well, that penny made a difference back then, because a penny, you know, if gas was 30 cents a gallon, 30 pennies, you know, 30 gallons, if you bought 30 gallons, that penny was a whole nother gallon. So you could buy 31 gallons. Nowadays, that penny, it's not going to matter. In fact, you got to figure out, and typically, and I've done the math on this. Now, it's not just the gas mileage that you're getting. Say you need to drive 2 miles further out of your way to get a gallon of to buy gas that's a nickel less than what you're paying at a pump close to you. And so now you got to figure in the cost of what kind of mileage you get. Now, that's not all there is in the calculation. You have to figure wear and tear on your car, because you have to calculate the price of per mile that it costs you to operate the car. And that's done over, really the only way to do that is do that over a course of years and keeping track of all your costs. We've done that so much at the beginning. Because I used to keep all the records on the cars, and we kind of average out how many miles we drove and what's it costing us per mile. I can't even remember back in the day when gas was a buck a gallon. Gas is actually a relatively small part of the operation of the car. It's the big bills that you pay once in a while that you have to realize, hey, that's a whole lot right there. For instance, if you were to pay, let's say you had a bill, let's do the math here. A $1,500 bill on your car. Let's say, $1,500. Make sure I double clear that, because I don't know what else was in there. $1,500 will buy you, how much gas that will buy you at $3 a gallon is 500 gallons. Okay, that's, now let's say you've got a 15-gallon tank. That's 33 times you can fill up. Let's say you fill up once a week or twice, even twice a week. That's 33 weeks. If you fill up once a week, 33 weeks. That's over 6 months. Let's just divide that here by four. Let's just see what we get. 4.1. I'm gonna divide by 4.1 because it's almost 8 months. So it's 8 months worth of gas for $1,500 that you've just paid to repair the car. And in that 8 months, something else is going to go wrong. It's probably going to cost you $200 or $300, whatever it is. Tires, whatever it is. Tires, brakes, all those other calculations that you got to put in there. And so in that $1,500, let's say that gets you another 10,000 miles. Well, that's still, let's see, 1,500, 10,000. So 1,500 divided by 10,000. That's 15 cents a mile right there. Just on repairs, 15 cents a mile. And then you figure in your gas price and everything else. It's costing you X amount of dollars per mile to operate the car. So you figure all those things out. By the time you drive a couple of miles away to buy, now the more gas you're buying, of course, the better deal it is. But let's say you're going to buy 15 gallons of gas. Then your car is almost empty or whatever. It's getting close. And you drive that car two or three miles out of the way, and then you drive two and a half, 3 miles back out of the way to get that gas. How much are you really saving? It's almost virtually nothing. You can do much better in your costs. By the way, this show is not normally about home budget economics. But that's what it's become here this morning, I guess. It is wishy-washy Wednesday. It can be anything, I guess. The basics of driving that car. So when you're just taking one less trip in that car. So making yourself more efficient. In other words, if say you got to go out and you got to get something at the grocery store, then you come back and I'm going to run over here and do this, I'm going to run over to that. The more you can do, every time you drive back and forth like that and make an extra trip somewhere, that's really, it just dissolves every bit of effort that you made to try to save that know, 10 cents a gallon or whatever it was, sometimes 5 cents a gallon, driving more efficiently, first of all, with that entire tank of gas. In other words, if you drive more conservatively with regard to speed, now, speed is kind of one of those, that's a tough one to make a call on, because sometimes your time is more valuable. It's worth the extra speed. However, jackrabbit starts from stoplights and all kinds of, I see people, I don't understand how people get there. Well, I know why cars don't usually last very long. My cars typically, we try to get them up to 300,000 miles. I've got one in the shop right now that is 320 some thousand miles. I've decided to put a new engine in it. It's not a new engine, but another engine with a lower mileage engine. The car itself is in great shape. Just, you know, the brakes are good. The tires are good. Everything's good on it. Transmission's good. Most of my cars have over 200,000 miles on them. But almost all of them that before we get rid of them or before they crash, they have 300,000 miles on them. And so it's one of those things where if you're not just beating the daylights out of it, and I know these cars are kind of designed, I drive Volvos and they are kind of designed to be driven heavily, but that I see people at stoplights. And the next light is red. You know it's going to be red. It's turning red as you're getting a green light. And they just trump, and they'll do everything they can. If they're right up on your tail, they'll do everything they can to get around you, to be one car ahead of you at the next stoplight. Or if they're in the lane next to you, they take off like crazy, go buzzing down the road like as if they're going to get there quicker, and you both show up at the light at the same time and stop. And I do not understand the mentality of, why are you beating the daylights out of your car? Do you realize how much more stress you're putting on all the components of your car? Now, once in a while, it's good to get on it, open up the throttle, get the carbon burned out of the thing, just let it wide open, kind of do its thing. That's okay for it once in a while. But every stoplight. Now, some car dealers will tell you, the car's designed to do that. Yeah, it's designed to do it for a while. You're operating at its max ability, and that's just never where you want to be. You don't want to be close to the red line all the time. And that's why most people don't usually drive their cars much more than 100,000 miles before they have to get rid of them, before they're just completely worn out. And, so many things are worn out on them. It's too cost ineffective to fix them up and keep driving them. That's good tea. So now, there you go. Now, that all being said, taxes, as I was saying earlier before I was so rudely interrupted by myself, I have, people are starting to wake up to this idea that taxes are very, intrusive into our lives. They're taking a huge chunk out of our ability to acquire, develop, invest, to build wealth, to real wealth, not just phony wealth. Getting people out of debt is a huge process. I have a lot of respect for Dave Ramsey. Not everything he says is gold. It's obviously his principles work. He's done a lot of studies. His group has done a lot of studies on, how do people become millionaires? How do millionaires spend their money? What does it look like? How do they get there? Because there's a lot of millionaires out there, and it's you wouldn't know it. The Millionaire Next Door is probably one of the better. I think who wrote that book? It wasn't Ramsey, was it? Well, let's just find out. We have the World Wide Web right here at our disposal. It's right here in front of me. The Millionaire Next Door. What was right there? Thomas Stanley. Oh, is there more than one? Do you have more than one publication? Yeah, The Millionaire Next Door. A Wealth of Common Sense, Seven Attributes of the Millionaire Next Door. The Millionaires Next Door is disciplined with their money, are more likely to drive a Ford than a Bentley and avoid status symbols. That is a big deal. That's a big part of the whole millionaire thing. Knowing how to invest and all that kind of stuff is all well and good, but having the money to invest and actually building wealth is a whole other story. And it's I have not read this book. I should probably get this and listen to the, I need to listen to the Debunking the Millionaires. Now, there's a lot of controversy around this book as well, but it's, you know, the statistics really are pretty overwhelming. Now, I don't know if Dave Ramsey ever, it seems like he has referenced this book before. I don't listen to Dave all that much. I listen to a lot of his excerpts and shorts and highlights. But I've been through his Financial Peace University a couple times, actually. And I really appreciate it. It is, the biggest thing is getting out of debt and understanding what wealth is. There are those who say that you can still borrow money and you can live on other people's money and everything. It just, you know, it really, and I see people buying new cars. There's a guy a couple of years ago, this guy was older than me. He was beyond retirement. I think he was 67, I think. 67 is full. I think it was his full retirement age. It's going to be mine. I know that most people right now, around my age, 67 is going to be their full retirement age. Otherwise they get full benefits at 67. If you wait longer, you get more, but it's considered full benefits. And, you know, there's all kinds of options out there. If you start taking Social Security early, you take a penalty, and then plus you have to pay taxes on it. If you're still working somewhere, they for every dollar you make, they for every $3 you make or $2 you make, whatever the formula is, depending on how much you're making, it's over a certain amount, then they start taking that out of your benefit. I would not get any benefits. Let's just put it that way. If I started taking Social Security now, I wouldn't get anything. Because what I thought about doing was taking the Social Security, taking the hit on the tax, on the income tax, just taking every penny of that and putting it into an investment of some sort, some index fund or something like that. It doesn't make any sense. I wouldn't get anything, first of all, and it wouldn't. So I'd be. Now, when you reach 67, at a certain point, they start to recoup. You start to recoup some of that loss, and it comes back to you after a while. But you never get it. You never get all that back. However, you've been taking it in for a longer period of time. I think I'm going to be best off at about 67. It looks like. I might wait till I'm 70. I don't know, but it's one of those things again where it depends on what kind of. I don't know what my income's going to be like after 65. It's always questionable. I do have a pretty good solid position right now with the job I have, which is I have to mandatorily retire at 65. So after that, it's questionable whether I will have as much coming in. I potentially could. I mean, the business that I have could be, AI could start taking a big chunk out of that business. And I may want to consider, you know, I might have to consider other things that aren't quite as easy to do. They might be a little more labor intensive, which I'm kind of setting myself up with plenty of equipment and tools and apparati that I can actually tinker around and do some hobby jobs, hobby businesses that will actually provide some income. And I'm hoping that kind of, because I enjoy business. Some people like real estate. They can like rental properties, that kind of thing. You still have to do a lot of work with rental properties unless you have somebody else managing them, and then you don't make anything. So it's other than the investment that you have in it. And that's not really what I'm into. I like to be able to have a little more hands-on with some helping other people start businesses or being a part of businesses that are startups. And so I want to do more of that. That's kind of more what I'm into. So I've been investing in some stuff like that because it's real stuff. It's real equipment. It's very tangible. It's not just, you know, the value of those things can go up over time, especially if you refurbish them and do some other things. They're solid investments. So as solid as can be. I mean, nothing's totally solid, but it's a fun experiment. It's a fun adventure, and I've diversified into some other things as well. So it's just different kinds of businesses that I could start that might have some potential. And so sitting down here is just, I think I want to stand for a while. So I'm going to stand. I got this little thing. I can stand up. I can actually stand up and do the show. So I'm gonna stand here for a little bit. I've got a little bit of a cramp in my leg. sitting there the way I was. So what we have, you can probably tell the difference between in the sound of my voice. I don't know if you can tell the difference in the sound of my voice when I'm standing or not, because it really does make a difference. For one thing, that the room is treated a little differently. As I stand up, it looks a little, it actually hits the microphone a little bit differently. There's a little bit different bounce in the room. But there's also, let me do this because it's, there we go. That's where the microphone's supposed to be. You also speak differently because you have a different, what's the word? You have your diaphragm, you're not crushing, you're standing up straight. You've got a different projection. You've got all this different stuff that happens. And your voice really does sound differently. Now, many times when I'm doing voiceover work, if it's, depending on what the genre, the niche of the voiceover is, sometimes I will stand up to do it. Sometimes I'll sit down. There's even some coaches I've seen that'll tell people to lay down and read script because they want it to be really laid back. You know, put a pillow under your head, sit there and read the script and act like you're on the beach. Pretend like you're on the beach and you're reading the script because they really want it that relaxed. There's other times when they really want you on your toes and they really want you to, right now, downtown, something such forward, it's got to, whatever it is, they want all this energy in it. So they want you to stand up and shake your hands. And so people look crazy. If you see them in the sound booth, they look crazy because they're putting a lot of effort. And it comes through in your voice. The way you move your hands, everything that you do has a difference in the way it resonates in your chest and everything else. And it really does make a difference in the way your voice sounds. Like I'm going to talk to you right now, just with my voice. I'm just using my voice. And I'm going to say the lazy brown dog jumped over the fox. Let's say the lazy brown fox jumped over the lazy brown. The quick fox jumped over the lazy brown dog. Let's just put it that way. Quick fox jumped over the lazy brown dog. Now I'm going to say the same thing, and I'm going to put some hands into it. Well, let's do it this way. You tell me which way, what you hear when I say this. The quick red fox jumped over the lazy brown dog. The quick red fox jumped over the lazy brown dog. Now I can tell the difference. Probably you can too. I'm putting more body English on the second one than I did on the first one. That's probably pretty obvious. Actually, it's ridiculous. But but it does that to you, and it changes your state of mind. It changes everything about it, and you can hear it in the voice. So I don't know why I'm getting into this. Actually, why am I talking about this? So getting back to the investment stuff. And building wealth. And most people don't realize taxation is a big part of what robs you of your ability to build that wealth. I mean, you've only got so much labor. You've only got so much time. You've only got so much that you can do to earn. And when they start whittling that away, instead of that money going into something that can build wealth, it's going into something that is relatively just down the toilet. Now, infrastructure, there are some things that government spends money on that actually is worthwhile. Infrastructure is probably one of those things, if everybody's on the up and up, you know, the biggest problem with infrastructure projects, while they're very much needed, the biggest problem with them is that there's a lot of corruption in the process. And this is very evident, and I'm going to get into this thing that's going on in Chicago right now with Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But as is typical, we will use Chicago as an example in the past, what has happened in the past. They have, and this is pretty much because it's very common everywhere with state, local governments, everywhere, city, state, county, whatever it is. So many times, now it's harder to do at the smaller levels. Now you get into a big city, a city reaches a certain point, a certain GDP. It's hard. They get away with this stuff a lot. Now it's smaller towns, there's a lot more oversight. Everybody's watching a little bit more closely because you can. And of course, the prices of your taxes and your property taxes kind of make a difference. However, here's the in the big cities, a lot of times you'll have divided up into sectors and precincts and everything else, and they'll have aldermen or whatever they have that kind of run certain sections of the city. And of course, those aldermen are responsible to the people in that particular group, and that's in that set of that part of the community. So it kind of gives smaller representation, a little more accountability. However, there's also more of a chance for corruption in some pockets. So what ends up happening is they say, well, we got this this new say this infrastructure, whatever it is, a bridge, whether it's a bridge or whether it's a some kind of a walkway, a trail, bike path, park, whatever it is, new stoplight, whatever it is. They want to put this thing in, or they want to put in a new subway, you know, some kind of big project. It's going to cost, $100 million. And it's going to take 5 years. Well, first of all, it's going to take 2 years. Let's say $100 million is going to take 2 years to get it done. It ends up taking 4 to 6 years and costing $200 to $300 million. Now, it used to be that it was just double. You just double everything, and it was about right. You'd come in about right. So it's going to cost, really, by the end, it was going to be done $200 million, and it was going to take 2 years. That's not the case anymore. It's closer to triple now, because they know how to play the game now. Within the contracts, the contractors that come in and say, we can do this for whatever it is, this price. And, of course, there's only a limited number of contractors that can do some of these big projects, because it requires a huge amount of, you know, there's the manpower, let alone the equipment, everything else. Not everybody has this kind of heavy equipment. There's just not that many companies around that have. It's much like Halliburton with regard to the military industry. It's just, there's only so many companies that have the ability to do this stuff. So you're really kind of limited in who can take a bid on some of this stuff, because they've made the investment in all the things that are required. And it's just, of course, they make that money back, you know, many times over, because they have the right equipment to do the job. But they took the risk in getting the equipment. So that's just the way it works. Now, the problem with this is, within the contracts, and so you got a couple things going on. You have a board of a city board council, whatever it is, city council. So the mayor has to sign off on all this stuff, right? So that's city council decides they're going to go ahead and approve that, the mayor wants to put in a bridge over this particular railroad track because it's causing a lot of traffic delays, to people go around, and emergency equipment. They'll have all these reasons, you know, emergency equipment, all this stuff, and school and buses and everything else has to wait on the trains and blah, 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 blah. So we need to put an overpass in here. So we're going to buy up these houses by eminent domain. We're going to pay for these houses, take these people's homes, and we're going to raise those, and we're going to go ahead and put this bridge in. And in the process, it's going to cost us X amount of dollars. And then the city council has to approve it. Then the city council has to put out for bids for whoever's going to do this project, right? Because the city doesn't own the equipment to do this stuff. They might own some equipment to maintain things like street cleaners, sweepers, some pavement, you know, patching, repair, cut type things. Many times those are even contracted out, which is fine. Let them bear the brunt of that. It's a known cost quantity. But the problem, here's where the problem comes in. And, of course, the city has its own attorneys. They draw up these contracts. In the process of doing all this, there's this little thing called, well, you know, we have our little buddies here on the side. And say you have a town council and it has say, 8 or 9 people on it, or 10 people on it. What are the odds somebody on that town council is going to be the relative or good friend of someone who happens to own or work for or be an investor in the cement company that's going to be pouring all the cement? and is able to give them some kind of, feed them some kind of inside information about how to win the contract or what we can put into the contract to make it feasible so that they can have overruns and overpricing and all kinds of delay, you know, just all kinds of things built into the contract to make it more viable for the contractors. The contractor can come in with a bid that will fit under everybody else and yet still have the ability to make more than anybody else would have made if that, by doing it that way. So it gets them under the bar to win the contract and over the bar in making profits. And there, you know, just might be some feedback into somebody's campaign later on when they go to run for office. Just, you know, those little back room, dark room, shady secrets that have, you know, tend to happen in situations like that. That's what I'm talking about, folks. That's the kind of thing that happens. Now, Brandon Johnson, and I wonder if I can find this because it might be, it's kind of making some news here. He might be under investigation for what he just said recently. Yeah, let's just put in Chicago. Oops, Chicago. Yeah, I don't know how to spell Chicago. Hiring. Let's just put in the hiring process. CBS News. There were some good ones on here. This is all, of course, this Ilk Fox. Yeah, this is all major. Of course, none of the alternative media websites come up with anything here. Jason Whitlock. That might be one that would have. I'm not going to be intimidated. All this stuff. This guy is a real mess. Here we go. On hiring black workers, we're the most generous. Yeah, here. This is 47 seconds long, and my guess is this is going to have everything that we want out of it. This is by Off the Press. I think it's either going to be. Oh, that's a new. Yeah, let's just put. I think this is just him talking. So let's see. Let's see what he has to say here. This is extremely racist talk, by the way. What he does in this, if this is the right clip, we'll see if it is. We'll just let him play it.
Two administrations ago, 70-75% of the administration is primarily made up of white and white men. In my administration, 45% of my administration is black, 25% is Latine, 30% is white, 8% is Asian. It is the most diverse administration in the history of Chicago.
Now, if you look at the demographics of Chicago, it does not follow. But we'll talk about that later.
There are some detractors that will push back on me and say, you know, the only thing that the mayor talks about is the hiring of black people. No, what I'm saying is when you hire our people, we always look out for everybody else.
When you hire our people, you say this is divisive talk, folks. He thinks in everything in terms of color. Everything's in terms of race. Which is in my, I just think it's just, I don't, what is it just me? Is it just my white privilege? Or do I find this, is my disgust for this kind of, it's just disgusting.
We are the most generous people on the planet.
Therefore, they should be in charge because they're the most generous. Let's see what else he has to say.
I don't know too many cultures that have play cousins. That's how generous we are. We just make somebody a family member, right? This is how we are.
Now, this only goes on to that point. What he says after that, and maybe the next one we'll see. Let's see if there is. I don't see anything else.
You cannot make.
No, there's nothing else on here. He goes on to talk about how he starts listing all these people who are in government offices. The chief of police, black man. He goes through like 25 different agencies within the city. They're all black. Right after he says his people, the black people, are the most generous people on the planet. Folks, that's a statement of superiority. This is black supremacy. Call it what it is. If you can take something and switch the white to black or the black to white that someone says, and all of a sudden it sounds like a racist or a white supremacist, then it is. And if it's a black supremacist or a white supremacist, it's still a supremacist. And it's racism. And it's hiring people based on their skin color, not on their merits, not on their abilities, not on the blind contract that it is. Well, we would hire you because your price is better and you do quality work. However, you're not black, so we have to hire a black person to do this. They are running into problems with the projects they're doing out at the O'Hare Airport right now. Because the company they hired, it had all the diversity. All the diversity was there. Because diversity is our strength. The problem is they're having to redo about 40% of the contract, the concrete work that was done by this one contractor, because they were the right color, but the concrete failed all the testing. The quality of the concrete was terrible. Let me be clear about this. The quality of the concrete wasn't terrible because they were black. It was because they were inept and unqualified. They were incompetent. And I would call them out whether they were white or black or whatever they were. Incompetence is incompetence. It's called based on the content of your character, your ability, your merit, not the color of your skin. So who pays for that? We all pay for that. Actually, the Chicago folks pay for that. But there's government funding going into the... I guarantee you they're taking government funding, government grants, and all kinds of things. So they're taking federal tax dollars, which we all pay for. That, to me, is one of the most disgusting things that I hear constantly from the black community, or just in general, the Democrat community. Somebody made a list of the top 10 states that have the highest state income tax. Every single one of them are blue states. They have Democrat governors, majority Democrat senators, their Congress and their Senates are majorities Democrat. They're blue states. Does it make you wonder? No, it shouldn't make you wonder. Why they have such high taxes, and yet they're falling apart. They have a mess of things going on. There you are. There you have it, folks. Again, it's been almost an hour, and most of that's just been me yakking. Hopefully, it's put those. If you're trying to listen to this to go to sleep, hopefully you're already asleep. And I'm trying not to wake you up here at the end. I'll talk quiet so you can drift off to sleep now. Hopefully I've made you too mad. Now you're going to be awake all night if you happen to be listening to this in the evening. If you're trying to take a nap. In the meantime, folks, I just wanted to cover a little bit of stuff about that. So Mayor Johnson now is under investigation by the feds because they claim that his hiring practices, he may be being, some of his federal funding, his federal support may be going away because he's breaking federal law in his hiring practices. And of course, he's saying, oh no, we're the most generous people on the planet. You're still saying it out loud that you're hiring people because of their race. They think they're immune to this. Their poop doesn't stink. Their racial poop doesn't stink. Now, you may not be a racist, but you're a racialist. You're using race in what you're doing. That's racialism, if not racism. But he's basically saying they're superior. That's what gives me. Folks, God bless. Have a great rest of your day. I'll be back tomorrow morning early. I'll be live. See ya.